Architecture Talks, the podcast about architecture from Jung. Analog or digital?
Both, I guess.
For both of you?
Digital more for me. I teach digital drawing. I'm very invested in that topic.
Build a new building or transform an existing one?
Transform an existing one. That's where our heart has been for quite a few years now. As we're a collaboration and we collaborate with others, that existing building becomes a critical collaborator. For me in particular, I've come to rely on as something that gives feedback, like a collaborator.
Davidson Raphaelidis investigates how to create long-lasting meaning in the built environment within a global economy that operates through business plans that focus on the short term. Davidson Raphaelidis investigates this contemporary dilemma through two venues. Firstly, by exploring a stable, long-lived architecture that is able to connect to people in fundamental, long-lasting, and immediate ways independent of short-lived official programs. A second category of project pursues this inquiry through unstable architecture that transforms over time. With unstable architecture, Davidson Raphaelidis investigates how architecture could respond and adapt to changing demands or simply disappear after its initial use. Four terms define the basic principles with which they themselves describe their work: inhabitation, time, expression, material. How these can be linked in both their projects and teaching is what we, Diane Slavik and Dr. Uwe Bresan, talk about today with Stephanie and Georg in our podcast.
Hello and welcome to Jung Architecture Talks podcast. Nice to have you both with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Inhabitation is a synonym for the act of occupancy or dwelling. Your architecture arises from a number of unfavorable parameters. Small plots, limited budget, little manpower. This usually creates constraints that you seem to effortlessly break free from and find new ways through a different approach to space. In an interview, you said, "We wanted the space to provoke the question of what else it could be used for." So how do you work? How's your approach to architecture in the beginning?
I think that you're right in bringing up constraints right off the bat, because the constraints, the particular ones that you mentioned, are ones that we really respect because they make our work, we think, relevant to a broader population. Constrained budgets, for example, are something that we don't see necessarily as unfavorable, but an opportunity to do something, you know, that others could do, others could replicate, rather than being a kind of prized one-off solutions that's seen as architecture. We really collect all of these constraints and try to make whatever we do spatially express them, but also celebrate them in a way. I don't know if that's too broad.
No, I think that's correct. I mean, we are only interested in architecture that potentially has a relevance for most people. And most people cannot afford huge budgets. So if architecture is supposed to be a mass medium, and if it's supposed to be relevant for most people, we think we kind of have to work with constraints. And inhabitation, in that sense, that was also brought up, I think, in the question. What's interesting about that is that inhabitation is like kind of the one thing that anyway one cannot design. We can design space and form and things like that. But then inhabitation is like that other exciting part that is unpredictable. So now you have the building on its own and its own agency, and people have their own ideas and they react to it. The kind of unexpected can occur.
So how do you find your clients? Or is it the way that the projects find you?
I think it's totally coincidence. Friends, maybe people who find that kind of thing interesting, they're drawn to it. And then we think like, oh yeah, it would be interesting to investigate like something like that. And this is how it then goes. So it's really more Like we were more like academics. And then from time to time, people got attracted to that work. And then we were able to put some of these investigations into the real world. So there's really no searching.
Yeah, we've fallen into just relationships through friends, friends of friends. And I think one common misconception is that people wouldn't be interested in an investigatory mode of looking at space, but that's not what we've experienced generally. I think when we kind of discuss things like extending the lifespan of a building, engaging more in maintenance and enjoying it, celebrating existing materiality and extending the lifespan, these are all things that, you know, building owners totally understand and appreciate.
That brings us to our next question. Turning to time and also speed, you wonder how an economy focused on the short term can actually create lasting meaning for the built environment. What would you say? What is the answer to this?
Well, we hope that like strong spaces that have like very specific character or idiosyncrasies, that they keep triggering interest or curiosity. And these kind of qualities are kind of totally independent from kind of maybe the beginning need or why something started. You know, the beginning need might be just like a business plan or like a very specific spatial need that arose. But these things that we then do, they tend to stick around. It tends to not disappear. So inevitably, it always reaches into a future where it starts relationships with all sorts of people in the future that we don't know yet. And we hope that kind of very strong spaces or very charged spaces are able to keep that curiosity going.
Yeah, I mean, spaces we're interested in and spaces we respond to and learn from are abstract, at the same time idiosyncratic. Often the idiosyncrasy comes in the form of material expression, or maybe form, or maybe proportion, but like kind of overarching spatial themes that don't necessarily conjure a specific image or make much sense until you see a space. And then there's a strong response. So we are looking and responding all the time. And that's one really helpful piece in working with existing buildings, that we can kind of apply a strength in something spatial, not programmatic, just spatial. And we try to amplify that or clear it up so that it is ready for whatever uses and users might come along. Or we add something that's not programmatically or use specific, but we think could resonate and be relevant to users decades from now, like the project, you know, Yuva with the large oversized masonry heater. In our climate in particular, like heat and the expression of heat and kind of haptic warmth is kind of always relevant in these long 6, 7, 8 month winters. So that had nothing to do with an original use or user or tenant or client per se. It was just something that we thought, okay, people in this climate, this will hopefully resonate and stick around whatever tenant comes into this corner shop. And so far, I mean, however many years, 7 years down the line, it has been used, this masonry heater, in ways, not necessarily in the winter, but also it's so decorative as kind of like a stage for children's spring performances, book sales, just things we haven't expected have happened.
That brings me to a point we were discussing in our preliminary conversation. You mentioned the architect Lina Bobardi as a role model and as an example of how buildings do not necessarily have to be an expression of their time. What fascinates you about timelessness?
That specific reference that you just brought up, and maybe that's not answering the question, but what interests us with her work, I think, is that the extraordinary is always put to service to the everyday. That's the main thing we love about her work, is that they're like very special spaces, very extraordinary situations, spatially, materially, tectonically, that are put into always the service of the everyday. I mean, these are very everyday spaces that are used by everyone, and we find that super exciting. And they're also very often done with low budgets and quite simple means, but very impactful spatial effects. Like we brought up that I think that the factory in Sesci Pompeia, where the main intervention is glass tiles in the roof, right? To bring light in from the top and having like a little river in the ground. And I think these are very unusual interventions, very simple interventions. They create a very interesting space where maybe the more typical solution might have been to replace the brick walls with expensive glass facade. But she didn't do that at all. So this kind of thinking is very exciting to us.
Do you have other role models besides Lina Bobardi?
I think it's important for me to say that the role models are the spaces. It's as simple as, you know, kids are amazing because they're so instinctive. And because our kids are with us also when we travel, road trips, wherever, we can immediately see with them whether they want to be somewhere or not, or they're just gone. And our role models are the spaces where we want to be, where all four of us are kind of like there and we're lingering and there's no real plan. There's not necessarily a commercial reason. We're not buying dinner or shopping. We just want to be there. And these are everywhere. And we don't necessarily look up the architect if it's an old building. We just look at the space and try to take note, okay, what is it about the space? Why do we want to sit here? Why are we sitting here, although we're done our ice cream like an hour ago? And these are our role models. We definitely look at our contemporaries and we celebrate and we're super excited right now with so much exciting work going on, I think, in Belgium and France. We look at historic precedents, but really we're suckers for these spaces where we want. We just went to Cleveland and we went to this amazing adaptive reuse. We just happened upon it. Grocery store that was in this old building that I believe was a bank. It was just a bizarre juxtaposition of like meat counter against this amazing dome with intricate paintings inside. We just kind of hung around. The public library in Cleveland from the 90s is an amazing set of spaces. So these spatial lessons are kind of everywhere, and those are role models for sure.
Yeah, because like with the idea that buildings have their own agency, the kind of original designer or whatever the intention was is maybe not that important anymore, and then we can take them seriously and take these building situations seriously. A lot of interesting spaces one can find is also in areas in the city that are more like maybe blighted. So in Buffalo, for example, there are a lot of areas, there's a lot of haphazard kind of construction and additions to buildings, but then like weird, funky, by chance, like kind of interesting compositions, you know, can be discovered there. Another area like that is when we like visit my parents in Greece, like 99% of the construction there is kind of do-it-yourself building activity over decades. And the most interesting weird situation can be found there. It's like an open platter. You can just like pick and choose like one strangeness after another. Really interesting.
I have the feeling we're already touching the next point. It's expression. Here we have found a totally untypical statement from you again. So we are inspired by very mundane things that happen in and around the city. The seasons, the snow, the everyday spaces. They are really informants of our way of working and thinking. We start with everyday ingredients, the guts of spaces, and try to squeeze something out of that. So how does this work? The squeezing something out of the guts of spaces. How do you start?
Well, we always need doors, windows, floors, ceilings. And it's amazing. Like you can always put these things together in totally different ways. And we love that.
And that's all. Just four walls, a roof, and a door, and some windows.
It's endless. It goes on. It's a door jam. It's the drywall. It's the switch. It's the pipe. It's the cable. Like all these things instead of, I mean, a good reference, of course, is Leverance for this, right? The flower kiosk with the cable in the wall. But you can think like this for everything. And because you need these elements anyway for everything, you can create expression without big budgets because, you know, these are the things you need anyway. Like, for example, when we did this patio, the outside room for the cat cafe, I mean, there was a need for an 8-foot wall enclosure. Otherwise, the cats would jump out. That is a need. But in a way, you can do this in like so many ways, right? And there is clay block. You know, clay block is a very simple way, like a large format unit to create a wall. But how you put these blocks together and what shapes it has and how an opening is formed and how a header is formed and the sill is formed and how the fleshing is missing on the top and these kind of things, like a little deviation on these everyday elements creates expression.
But you don't want to produce nice spaces or beautiful spaces. You talked about strange things or strange buildings. So maybe you don't want to do something aesthetical or beautiful. You want to do something else with the spaces. Maybe you can explain this a little bit more.
I mean, that's a really important point to us. I think, of course, the topic of beauty is so vast and it's different, of course, for everyone. It's different. But I think when we're engaged as we are just so constantly with analysis or observation in interrelationships, the objective becomes more compositional. And then there's actually no strictly good or bad, but there is like deliberate and there's thoughtful composition, right? But it's an ever ongoing study of an unsolvable topic, a fundamentally mysterious topic. And when you add three-dimensional space to the topic of composition, it's really endless. And I think rather than extracting observations like this is beautiful, this is nice, this is good, this is not good, it's a much more broad and nuanced kind of spectrum or terrain of responses. And those responses are also different depending on the person, depending on whether they're little, whether they're in a wheelchair, all of those factors, which are so variable as well. Whether it's winter and it's 4 o'clock and it's pitch dark as it gets here, you know, the mindset of the person. So that's why it's not on our minds to aim for beautiful spaces. And probably neither of us think in those terms. But as I mentioned before, with the road trip to Cleveland, we respond constantly. We take note of that. But we are also taking note, we're on, our switch is on to respond to spaces that are also kind of like oppressive, right? And I think we learn as much about space from those types of spaces as we do from spaces that I described before that are role models.
Yeah, I mean, one could say that the composition, like a strong composition, could be like one way of maybe what is called beautiful or what you're attracted to. So composition is very important. And by working like excessively with composition in a way, that is a way like being drawn to like making things that are appealing, kind of. But it's probably a mixture of many things, like in which context is it? Like a clay block is interesting maybe in one context, but in another, maybe not. In a way, like when is it interesting? When is it not? When is it architecture? When is it not? So there are a lot of maybe instincts that are at play with composition. And then maybe also like a lot of things that are more like conceptual, you know, like of thinking like, oh, in which context does it work or does it not work? But we are drawn to strong compositions.
That leads us to our last topic, material. We already mentioned it before in a way. Working with tight budgets often requires unconventional strategies. For example, in the use of materials, but also how to make virtue out of necessity and turn the absence of excessive technology into an architectural concept for two uses. You were already talking about it, summer and winter, and maybe day and night use. So the adaptive reuse is not a fad for you. It's a way to make a building talk. How does this work?
What's interesting, what you mentioned with the seasons of the day and the night, I mean, there's certain things that just don't change. I mean, the seasons are there and they are there in 150 years. So it's a very productive issue to work with. if you can make something interesting with the seasons, you are going to do something interesting in the long term. You can do something interesting with the day and night cycle, then you also are going to do something that's interesting for a very long time. If you do something that reacts to the context of a street or of an urban block, that's also very long term because these things stay the same for a long time. I guess like requirements of a specific person at a specific moment, these are more interesting to us to maybe have it as a starting point of thinking about something idiosyncratic. But just the fulfillment of these kind of very momentarily desires can never be a project, I think, for us.
Yeah, I like how you framed the question and asked, how do we make buildings talk? I think you said, because I think that does reflect how we interact or work with these existing structures, because they are very expressive. They are huge informants. They're really collaborators, and our work is a response to those existing structures, the material, the construction, the other constraints, the neighborhood, the site. And I think our tectonic interventions are very much thought about as dialogues, like what we add is some kind of talking to communication with what's there. It's not an answer, but it's kind of like a, hey, how are you? Should we do this together for a while? But we like it when tectonic is visible, because it relates to the culture of repair and change that we anticipate will happen, so that we start to think about it as like an accessible tectonic, something that you can see and modify, repair, maybe demount, unbuild to suit whatever needs might be there in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 years. But yeah, those insertions or those tectonic moves are very conversational and like a form of talking to something that's already quite expressive.
You both have been involved in teaching for many years, and in your work with students, you try to connect the design and material processes. So from your experience, how does a newer generation of architects view the challenges of our time? Is there a changing mindset within the students?
I think as a context, what's maybe interesting there too is teaching is super important for us. And the teaching that we do is also in the context maybe of where we are. Like, for example, where I'm teaching in Buffalo in the US, there are very different types of architecture schools. There are private schools that are kind of geared towards discourse building and being innovative, so that students are kind of trained to be kind of steeped in these questions that you're mentioning that right here. And then there are schools like the state schools, which are more schools for like educating like the everyday architect, where actually these kind of conceptual questions come less about, but it's kind of the everyday student that is able to attend university. And we find it very interesting in a way to teach in an environment where like the everyday student population is able to study, where architecture is not seen as a kind of elite discourse hobby. And I think that's different probably in Germany, where like all the schools are more similar, but in a way where we teach is more like the everyday bread and butter education, where the students maybe come less with like a preformed own mindset, but they more kind of curiously soak up what maybe we are offering. It's more like an everyday form of education.
I'll jump in. I mean, we're very different personalities, so we have different ways of, I think, relating to students. I just feel like a student, so I love students. It's my favorite context to be amongst people who are just open to learn and have a kind of humility. I wonder why that ever goes away. It shouldn't go away after graduation, I think. But to answer your question, something that I noticed in the last few years with all of the tremendous upset and upheaval and volatility is that my students care so much about what's going on in the world. They want to do something meaningful. I don't think they just want a job. They want to have agency in charting their own path And I have all the hope in the world and belief in them that they can. But something that I wish would be more broad are the opportunities and ways of working for people that are trained as architects, particularly in North America. Back to what Georg was saying, because once they end up going into a large commercial office, sometimes that can lock people in. You know, you need money, everyone needs money, everyone needs to pay bills. And then it's not like someone's coming to your door and asking you to work differently or take risks at all. But there are not many different modes of working with space. And I think space reflects that. Space become homogenous.
You also wrote a book together for students, and the book is called Processes of Creating Space. It's a workbook for beginning architects and designers that shows how to generate space with user experience always in mind. So this is one topic in your teaching. Did you have always the client or prospective client in mind?
So that book actually is kind of set up to introduce chance in the design process. So what happens there in the process of the book is that random aspects are thrown into the design process and the students kind of have to make sense of it.
Can you give examples for these random things that come into the design process?
So the book is set up in a way to, it's the first semester, so the students don't know any media, any drawing, any modeling techniques. So these drawing and modeling techniques are used to create form. For example, they have to find a space that they find interesting of a certain size in their own home. And that trains the observation skills. Then they have to photograph that space, and that trains like the skill of photography. Then they have to write about that space, a paragraph. And now they invert, they're discovering totally different qualities about that space. Then they make a mass model out of it, out of foam. And that's the first time when they use the foam cutter. But now that space is a solid. It's a solid void inversion. And then when they have that solid, they have to make a plaster mold out of the solid. So investing that foam model in plaster with a lot of different pieces so that you can take it again apart. So you could replicate that space. But these mold pieces are, again, new forms. They have imprints from that foam model in the middle. And all these plaster pieces, which is like a set of five or six forms, right? They again become spaces because now they have to draw a perspective of each of these blocks. So they're inverting that, they can make them hollow through perspective, and they learn how to draw a perspective. And now I have these five or six spaces, and now they have to design a house by assembling these forms. So there's a lot of randomness going on. They constantly have to make sense out of it. The students have to learn how to make sense out of these constraints and out of these very intriguing spaces that happen then at the end.
That sounds fantastic. I would have loved to start my studies with you if I think about the beginning of my architectural studies. That was kind of a little different.
Well, I think the most important thing to say, which Georg did mention, is that the whole process starts with the students finding a space on their own in the same way that I talked about our road trip to Cleveland. And this was super important to us to get away from this idea of a pilgrimage to Europe for these North American students in the Rust Belt. This is still super important to me, and I'm not a fan of these architectural pilgrimages. I try to encourage students to look around, look as they walk, look as they're going to buy groceries, just have the switch always on, because those spaces are everywhere. And in a way, it democratizes the study of space, of architecture, really radically. That's something that we believe in. And it relates to adaptive reuse. You know, if you just appropriate a space, and these spaces that the students chose and that are shown in the workbook are really not these classically designed spaces. They're found everyday spaces. But if you kind of manipulate the found space volumetrically, it yields unending marvel. And that's kind of like the overarching theme, like lessons about space and keying into the mystery and the complexity of three-dimensional space. Those lessons are everywhere. But the key is to look and engage with space, not to work strictly from imagination or this tabula rasa approach.
So let's move on a two-dimensional level. We heard that drawings, sketches, animations play a big role in your work. Georg, you're fascinated by Japanese drawings from the Edo period. Can you tell us why?
Well, what's interesting about them is that a lot of different stories can happen in one image. So it's kind of like if you would like to capture, let's say, a whole movie in one image, that would be the way to do it. It's also parallel projection, so it has this incredibly the density of activity in one image. And we think that's a very interesting case study to show how inhabitation could be captured in a drawing.
Stephanie, do you have a favorite too?
I mean, I have endless appetite for spatial representation. We're actually working right now with a bunch of colleagues from all over the world collecting amazing drawings for an auction to hopefully generate some money for a food program in Toronto. And so this has meant I've spent maybe the last 2-3 months just combing the internet, combing Instagram, who is drawing, who might contribute to drawing. And it's so inspiring just to see the breadth of approaches. I feel really confident in saying there's like a refreshing absence of a trend. Manual drawings from Nuno Souza, I was just looking at this morning. We were participating in a drawing project in France from Ferro Prosacco, and all of those drawings in the catalog, they're so different, although we were given super strict constraints to modify an object, and they just said use drawing as an approach. And there are manual drawings, there are collages, there are, you know, wireframe complex digital drawings. I have an appetite for all of it. And I just don't feel like I can live long enough to draw enough because it's so time consuming. So that relates back to the topic of time. Drawing takes so much time. It's a bit of a stumbling block.
At the end of our podcast, we have a more private question for you now. So you are a couple, you're living together, you have children, and you are also business partners and you have your office. So do you have a special division of labor? Do you have different strengths and areas of responsibility in your partnership?
We were thinking about this, I think, many times. And I think what's really interesting, yeah, we have for sure strengths like each, but they're not divided in any easy way.
So what is the complicated way?
The complicated way is that we're involved in everything always kind of together. So I know that the work would not look like the way it is in any way if it would not be done together. It would be something very different. It's that integrated from the very beginning to the very end. It's so intertwined that none of the work would remotely look the way it is if we wouldn't work together. So it's a very, maybe even inefficient kind of
it's inefficient
collaboration, but very tightly intertwined all the way to the end.
The topic of collaboration and some kind of creative pursuit is fascinating to me. I would like to know more about how others work really in a truthful way, because I think for us, the hard truth, as Georg was kind of pointing to, is that the work is better if we struggle through it together. The work is its own thing if it comes from both of us. I personally, because it is so slow to work together and work through options together, and it involves so much discussion and also disagreement, I often have the urge to work alone on something. And I always see and feel it's weaker. I always see that. And it's not a good feeling, but it validates the need to struggle through collaboration, but it's not easy. But in a way, we've come to believe in it, you know?
I mean, I worked in other offices and I saw like the division there. And I mean, they're very often like there's a designer, there's the whatever, the one who's good with contracts, there's the one who's good on the building side. Like very clear, like from one department to the next. And it's not at all like this. And I don't know why that is. It just is not like that. And it's very inefficient, but I think it creates an intensity about the end result that we like.
Maybe it's interesting to say, because I wonder this about other collaborations. I would say that with every decision, like with all of the hundreds of decisions in each project, if you took our names, you could always amplify one of them. Now, one of them had a stronger hunch about it, and the other was like participating, but okay with it. So it's not like we're a merged, unified, single mind at all ever. We always struggle through things. And I think one of us is always a little more amplified than the other with every decision.
So that makes us curious what the last answer will look like. To conclude our podcast, there is one final personal question. The future lies in existing building stock. Which contemporary building would you like to alter, rebuild, or continue to build?
We can answer that next week. I think we can think about it. That's the thing. Like, I mean, we described like how we can look at any strange corner and find like an amazing composition in it. It could be anything, really. And I think that's also like one thing of how we work is there's not like, oh, if we could do this one thing, that would be amazing. Anything is really amazing. It really is.
That sounds like a perfect conclusion on our talk. Everything can be amazing.
Anything is amazing.
Yeah.
No, it only depends how you see it.
I mean, if you think of the most detested types of buildings that are typically really reviled in architecture, strip malls. I mean, we've taken that on with gusto. We really actually enjoy the mall, but that's probably becoming more typical that malls are proving to be quite flexible and elastic in what they can offer to communities. That's pretty interesting. But maybe the most interesting thing to take on in a decade would be what we find the most difficult to like or to be interested in, which are the developments that are going all over North America, right around us, right down the road, you know, with the same house just replicated, very tight, no trees yet, so very sad looking. And I think it's difficult to be lured into those, but maybe once they've been tinkered with in a decade or two or 50 years, they can capture more of our intrigue. But yeah, anything is amazing. I think I jump on that.
Yeah, that sounds perfect.
And if you like, you can phone us in 1 week and tell us the one building.
Well, this has been a great journey of inspiration. Thank you so much for this talk and being that open, giving us so many insights. It's goodbye from us until the next episode of the Jung Architecture Talks, the Jung Architecture Podcast.